Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge and we're very glad to have you with us. This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, our guest is Arne Tjorn Pond. You just heard a mention of the fact that he was here visiting the campus and would be giving a talk as part of the MillerCom series. And again, that's happening tonight at 7 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium on the U of I campus. It's quite a story that he has to tell. He was just a boy when the Khmer Rouge took over in Cambodia, where he was born and did some of his growing up. He was sent to a labor camp for children. Sometime after that, he and other children were given guns and they were sent out to fight the Vietnamese, to fight as child soldiers. And he says that through all of this, the one thing that kept him alive was music. This morning, we'll be talking with him some about his early years in Cambodia and also his work today as a human rights activist and advocate for traditional Cambodian arts. He is the subject of a very interesting film documentary that aired nationally on public television called The Flute Player. I had a chance to see it myself, and it is available on a DVD, so I would suggest people seek it out and see if they can see the movie. And of course, people who are interested in hearing him can go to the talk tonight, these MillerCom events. They're always free and open to the public, and certainly anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. And here this morning on our program, questions and comments are welcome. If you would like to call in, you're certainly welcome to do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333 WILL or 9455, and we do have that toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number, and that's 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you're interested in calling in, you certainly should do that. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
And we really appreciate it.
Inviting me.
You were, when the Khmer Rouge took over, you were nine?
Yes, around nine. I'm not too sure. I wasn't too sure about how old I was or how old I am.
Do you remember really clearly what happened there in that first day or few days?
Sure. During the Khmer Rouge came in, you mean?
Yes.
Yes, I was in a playground. I was on my way to my home from the temple where I was sent to learn the Sanskrit chant, Buddhist chanting, and serve the Buddhist monk for instructions of my own language. I served them. They taught me how to chant and to learn my own language. I was on my way there from the temple. It was about like 2 miles from the temple to my house. So I was walking there, 75. And I saw tanks and trucks came in with all the noises. On the truck and on the tanks were black soldier wearing black, you know, with their cap on, with their scarf on their neck. And it's Cambodian traditional scarf, but they were like cap they wear. We didn't know why all of them wear that caps. Like a hat, and they were not cheering, but people were cheering for them, and I was watching like other people on the street were cheering. They say, "Oh, peace coming!" And the Khmer Rouge took over. They beaten American. I heard the word American, but I never met any American, Yeah, then the tank stopped and the truck stopped and it was like chaotic everywhere. And then, some of the soldier was like almost as big as I was, as small as I was. Mm-hmm. You know, I was so some of them came in. They dropped off their they jumped from the truck and from the tank to come down, and I tried to teach them how to play ball, you know, soccer ball. They were curious or something, but they were not smiling at all, and they were very awkward in playing ball. They don't know how to do it. So I knew that the Khmer Rouge was up to something. I saw them at that moment. One of the boys just go went up to the highway and stopped a motorcycle, and he asked if he can borrow a motorcycle, and the guy didn't give it to him, and he hit the guy with the back of the gun in the head and fall down. That was the first time I saw anything like that in my life, you know, not in the movie anymore. Mm-hmm. I used to go and watch movie before the Khmer Rouge came, you know, in 1974. I used to take my brothers to go to a movie theater in the town, you know, holding people's hand because we didn't have the money to pay. We holding the adults' hand, and they took us in. We watch already like kung fu movie and American, you know, war movie, I don't know what war against who, I don't know, but I like the, with my brother, I would come out from the kung fu movie, we would imitate the kung fu, and I beat up my brother and all of that, blood coming from his face and stuff. It was an accident. But soon after that, then the Khmer Rouge came in, and again, this time, I really see the real one that they did right in front of me. And I knew that the Khmer Rouge had something. And I went and tell my mom, my aunt who took care of me since I was young, about it. She didn't believe me. Mm-hmm. And then 3 days later, the Khmer Rouge came in with the loud microphone, and they were on the truck, and they said to us, they said you all has to leave tomorrow for 3 days, then you will return, because the American get angry at us, they're gonna bomb everywhere, so and you all gonna die if you don't leave. So that was it. The next day, I saw thousands of people packed on that highway. And I heard gunshots already, and people running off from the highway, and the Khmer Rouge shot them, and all this. It's all chaotic after that.
So they took everybody out. They took people out to the countryside.
Yeah.
They split families up. Men went into one camp. Women went into another camp, and children went into another camp. They separated everybody.
Yeah.
What was life like for you as a child in this? What was a labor camp for children?
It's place where they took me, particularly with seven other 100 kids, ranging from age probably 5 to 12. They, you know, the Khmer Rouge did a campaign of strict division. Like you say, the parents are with the parent, the mom, the dad, and the sister. They go with the sister. And you are not allowed to meet each other, sometimes by letters, but they say there's no communication because you have to work really hard, otherwise you're going to starve to death. They starved us anyway. But there are regular camps that people work. It's a rice field. In fact, I didn't know that the whole country was a camp. I didn't know that. All I feel was that, like, silence. Everybody now start working and not saying anything. And, you know, at this point now, the Khmer Rouge has start killing killing people right in front of us. They're not ashamed of, you know, afraid of doing that. They go around with the paper and pencil, and they jot down people's name and what they did in the past. So people will be beginning to be disappearing, and then they try to run, and they kill them right in front of us. So we know now not to say anything. For me, I was taken to a temple area, a Buddhist temple, where we were forced to, and they were behind the main temple. There was also another. There were old monument, you know, like a monument built in maybe the 9th to 10th centuries, called Wat Aik in Battambang, and we were sent there. We were not prisoners. The 700 kids. We were sent to live there and to work there and to die there, but the prisoners were put in different place nearby us in the main temple, and you know, they start killing these prisoners now like 2 times a day, 3 times a day, sometimes 4 or 5 times a day in the middle of the night. And sometimes they would kill 3 people, sometimes 5, sometimes 20, sometimes 50. They kill them only with special acts, you know, like they made a special act, this 3 or 4 men who, before they kill, before they go to kill these people in the mango grove across my center, we can just see it. It's like across many few meters, and they would wear white shorts, you know, white shorts and sometimes shirts. And so when they kill the people, their blood's all over them. So they, you can see the blood stain in their shirts and their pants. I'm not sure why they did that, but there were special acts they make. Small, you know. I'm not sure why they didn't shoot, because the, I think, I don't know, they, later on I knew that they were saving bullets to fight the Vietnamese. But, you know, they have a plan. We don't even know anything. Mm-hmm. And so they kill with sticks and axe, and they punish, you know, all those victims, you know. Like they would come out, and every day, every evening, they would brought these people into the front of the main temple and punish them, you know. Like a girl, this girl refused to cut her hair because she likes her hair. She probably a performer. She liked her hair long, and the Khmer Rouge said, "Oh yeah, you talk back to me, you know. Now girls are not they you don't care about beauty anymore. You are now working. You cut your hair short." She said, "No, you can kill me and all this." And then they put her on a drum, the Buddhist drum in the temple, and they put her in the drum and they burn her. Sort of, they put smoke into the drum and they bang the drum, and she would come out with blood on from her nose and from her face. And they kill her eventually, but they play game with them. And there were like Americans, a former Cambodian soldier who pro-American. I saw him, very big muscle, like three or four of them big. And they were like a big guy, you know. And the Khmer Rouge would take him out into the front of the temple. They would beat him every day. They beat him in the joint, you know. They hit him in the joint every day. He became like a vegetable every day. And they asked, sometimes they asked us to go and help out too. And he eventually hit in the head a few months later, and they put American helmet in his head, and they put cigarettes in his mouth, and they were laughing. It was raining, and I saw them do that, and he was propped. I don't think he died yet, but then they later on they took him to the mango grove, like everyone else. Yeah.
The Khmer Rouge particularly singled out people that they thought were intellectuals, people, and also artists, performing artists. And you actually, your family, you'd come from a musical family, but you understood that if the Khmer Rouge knew that, that they probably would want to kill you too.
Sure,
so you didn't do anything to make it known that was the family.
No,
that you had
in fact, I don't know why they killed. They kill every day, everybody. I didn't know. I didn't reason why they kill this or that that time. I didn't know why, but they just kill everybody, and it's not like if they know that my family was owned an opera. I didn't know for sure why they were doing, like, they kill even people who has scar in their, like, indicated that they wore glasses before. It's an indication of that they were reading things, you know. They anything that they think that's pro the West, especially pro Americans. You know, so even for me, if they didn't know that I play music, during the time I didn't play music, I didn't know how to play music, and my family were, you know, owned an opera, but I didn't really know. I was really small, but they just, I had a lighter skin. You know, my skin is lighter than most of the Khmer Rouge were, like, darker. They were farmer. Most of them were farmers. They were recruited by the Khmer Rouge to be against the city people. And the city people means that you're rich. The rich people means that you associate with the education. Education means that you associate with the American, with the West. So they kill everybody that, for me, they would have killed me anyway, because my skin lighter and my finger looked like a girl. They said that I'm from the rich family that pro-American. They wanted to kill me. But during the time, I tell you, in the middle of this killing everywhere, they wanted to start a musical group that play their revolutionary song using the traditional instrument to play their revolutionary song. So I knew I would have died if I worked like everybody, every children. They killed some of those children too, even though we're not prisoners. But those children are now starving. Like sometimes we would wake up at 5 in the morning and work until 12 in the rice field. And there were like 1 week, there were no food at all, just drinking water. And many children were starving to death. And then they say, oh, the children are now can't work anymore. So they kill them. Just that we can't work anymore. And these children are from, you know, 6 years old to 12 years old. So, and I was asked to watch a lot of killing while they were killing and help them to take off clothing from the victims and stuff like that. And I just pick anything that move on the ground and trying to survive. And I raised my hand to play the music for them. There were 5 kids who raised their hand to play the music. And there were one man who, white-haired, about 65 years old or something. They used to kill old people too, you know, because they say that old people are not productive in the society. They just scum in the society. They just eat and they don't do anything. So they kill a lot of old people before that. When they find out that the older people can take care of the babies, and they had old people take care of the babies while the parents are working on the field. So they, now this guy, I didn't even know his name. He came like only 5 days. He taught us and he said, you know, you guys need to work really hard. If you don't, they're going to kill you. So he know, and he also was killed 5 days later. They just teach us how to do like a dulcimer. I was taught first, not the flute, but the dulcimer. And the 3 kids that didn't succeed also kill. Only 2. I was the number 1, and there's another boy who's number 2, and they saved us. The number 3, number 4, number 5 were also ended up with my teacher in the mango grove. They killed them.
Because they weren't. Were lucky because you volunteered. I said, all right, I'll learn music.
Yeah.
And it turned out that it was very fortunate because you had a gift for it and you did it very well. And the other people that volunteered, they didn't play well. They killed them.
They ended up dead. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, they play game, you know. This Khmer Rouge play game, so much game, you know, that with the people's life and you are not allowed to cry at all. If they see children around, if you feel at all, they ask you to come and watch what they were doing, killing people and punishing people. They also watch. They put us in a circle and they would go around watching our faces. If they see us like we show any emotion for the people that they punished, they just take the kid and kill them right in front of us and say, here, if you feel sympathy for, they call it enemies, I don't know. I found out that some of the prisoner, or they call it victims, from the community that they brought to that temple, they never get out alive. And the thing is that they just stole, some of them stole an orange or cut cow tail to eat because they were starving in the community, and they call them enemies, you know, and they kill them.
So. Let me, for anybody who might have just tuned in, I want to introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Arne Chorn Pond. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to give a talk. This is a part of the MillerCom series. It's called The Flute Player, Moving Beyond the Madness of War. And it is about, he will be talking about his life, which is also the subject of a documentary film called The Flute Player that has aired on PBS. And if you get a chance to see it, I would certainly recommend it. He'll be talking some about his life, but also about his efforts to try to promote and preserve traditional Cambodian music. We'll be talking about that, too. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. His talk, by the way, is tonight at 7 at the Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum, and it is open to anybody who would like to attend. Just to push the story forward a little bit, I'd like you to talk a little bit about how it is that you ended up, and this, I think, was at the time when they gave the children guns when the Vietnamese invaded and sent you out to fight. You managed to run away, and I can't imagine how it is you actually managed to survive, but managed to run away to survive, make your way into Thailand, where actually you ended up being adopted by an American minister who brought you to the United States. How did you manage to get away, and how did you survive?
Through the jungle. I mean, I went crazy in the war because many of the kids were forced by the Khmer Rouge, thousands of them, into the front line to be decoyed and to just be mowed on by the Vietnamese because they were so good, you know, I couldn't take seeing my friend left and right dying, shot in the head, in the stomach by the war. And I just, you know, I knew that the jungle was vast. I probably knew I had a feeling. And you know, you have to make a decision quickly, otherwise you get shot by either Khmer Rouge or by the Vietnamese. And I just go and run off. I was probably 13, 14 during the time, and I have to figure out how to use the guns. No training. They said no time for training. The Vietnamese are good. Then you have to figure it all out yourself.
They just gave you the gun you figure it out and go there. There's the enemy. Yeah. Go and get them.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So many kids were blowing their own head off because they don't know how to clean the guns and all of this. And the Vietnamese were so good because they had experience with American. We didn't know that. You see, during the time, we were just a little kid. And so I couldn't bear seeing my friend died and feel very powerless and helpless, you know, to hold them while they were dying. I went crazy, and I just run off by ourselves. I went insane. So in the jungle, I never knew that there were Thailand out there. There were anywhere. I thought the world was flat, you know, never know anything. So I just shoot up in the jungle, and the jungle was very long. I don't know. Lucky, I keep walking toward the west, toward the sunset. That's where Thailand was, because the sunset and the guns were fighting between the Khmer Rouge and the Vietnamese was in the north. So I keep getting away from the guns and keep just walking in weeks and months, I think. In the jungle, it's very hard because of the snakes, you know, the smallest snake, the poison it will get. And they're all everywhere. The leeches is okay. The leech, you know, it sucks your blood, but you can't control very much because when you sleep, they jump from the ground and eat your blood. And I got cerebral malaria, and I only had one clothing. And sometime I walk, you know, like 1 or 2 weeks, and I found out that I was in the same place. And that when you want to shoot yourself because it's you feel so lonely and you don't know where were you going. Sometimes I was with people, but sometimes, many times, you just walk alone and you got lost. And you have to identify also fruit. There's so many fruit, different kind of fruits in the jungle, and you don't even know what it was. And you like taste it all out. If it's not poison, then you eat. If it's poison, it poisoned you. And I've got few time, you know, skin of my mouth fall, you know, like have wounds because of the poison. I also learned, you know, there are a lot of monkeys that they all up, you know, big trees, and they jerk around the tree, they play around, and there were fruit dropping from the tree. And usually when I pick the fruit that dropped by the monkey, I eat it whether sour or sweet, usually no poison. So I pick it, I eat it because I was small anyway. I can't climb the big tree anyway. I was not like Tarzan or anything like that. You know, I watch a movie here. I saw a movie Tarzan. You know, it's the same jungle, big jungle like that. But I wasn't big like him and go from tree to tree like that. But I was almost dying. You know, and pick up those the fruit that dropped from the monkey, usually okay. You know, I kill some monkey to eat too, like a little monkey that I can catch them. And I had a gun at some point, but I didn't remember where I throw the guns away after I cross. I was probably a little bit blown up, but there were the last fighting between the Vietnamese and the Khmer Rouge, and there were a bomb near the border where I sort of settled down and on my own, and then I crossed the river to the cornfield. I was scared to go to the cornfield because it's open sky. I don't know how long I spent in the jungle and all this, but I was so afraid, you know, to go out into the clear sky. And I don't know. I was found by the by five or six Cambodian girls. I was already on my last leg. I was unconscious, and then they took me to the camp. That's how I met my father. Yeah. Yeah.
When you came to the United States, it sounds like you know, your adoptive family, they were good folks, and they gave you a good life, and that you were doing well. And at the same time, the experiences that you had, everything that you had been through, had left its mark, and that it's something that you just couldn't forget.
No, not so well in the beginning. I know they are good people. You know, I've never met white people before. This is my first time I met white people, and it rang a bell in my head that the Khmer Rouge talk about American. So I never thought that I would end up meeting American and become my father. And he took me from Thailand, and in the camp, in Thai camp, they told us, you know, there were a lot of buildings, good building, cars, money in America. Don't worry. So I was expecting that. Then I come. My dad took me to New Hampshire. That's our house in the hip of the mountain, and there were jungle again. Like I was right away. I was angry, but again, I you know, at this point, I don't know where my family were for many years, and I was confused. And just last year, I was in the jungle, and now coming back to America, it's a jungle again. And then the next day, my dad took me to shopping, and to the mall, and I ended up shoplifting because I don't know the system. You know, I thought it was free. I saw my dad putting a lot of clothing on the trays and stuff like that. I said, oh, this is good. It's true. People say that in the camp that America has a lot of clothing and all of this. But then I ended up putting them in my pocket, and I didn't see my dad giving money to the anything, you know, when you the end of it, but then you give, you know. And I already put some stuff in my pockets already. And I got trouble earlier year. And then I don't know. And the next week, he took me to school, to high school, where a lot of all the kids are white kids, you know, a White Mountain Regional High School. And I feel like I go into the bee's nest, you know, like they come out from the class like a bees. And I didn't know anything. I don't know where to go. I didn't speak English. I don't even know ABC. So I don't know why my dad took me there and all this. So I was not easy, and my mom earlier year didn't understand why I behaved this way. I was angry all the time, and I had nightmares while, you know, there. And I didn't even know how to use a bathroom, to tell you the truth. I went to the bathroom, and I was scared to be sucked into, you know, the bathroom when you flush it. And I feel scared because I don't never know. I thought I was maybe sucked into the bathroom, and I didn't use the bathroom. I pee out of my window and all the time at night. And my mom came in. She smelled the urine, and everywhere she saw the, like, you know, fruit skins that I love, the fruit ball. You know, my mom put the fruit ball, and every 2 hours we would eat that all, the fruit ball. And my mom was very angry. I don't know why. And because I said, oh, the people say it in the camp that there's a lot of food and all that. It's right, you know, the fruit bowl she put like this. And every time I go to the fruit bowl and scavenge it. And I didn't know where to put the skin. You know, I don't know the trash can. I don't know anything. So I throw it, and I hide some in my pillow. And she was so mad, my mom. She didn't understand. My dad understood a little bit where we came from, but he was not at home. You know, he's now traveling, you know, doing a lot of work. So it was not, I run away from home, from school, and I feel angry. I feel I had a lot of fight with American kids. You know, they make fun of me, they call me names, and they also physically hit me, you know, and then they put their head and they put their hand on my head. That's in Cambodia, it's a very bad thing to do. Like somebody hit your head. You know, in Cambodia, they believe that the head is the Buddha, and your parent lives in your head. Nobody touch your head, you know. And so they hit my head, and I say, no, they don't understand. They make fun of me, and they make, you know. So when I hit them, you know, in the butt, you know, in the ass. I mean, in America, in Cambodia, it's all right if you hit someone in the ass. And I don't know what happened. In America, they get so angry at me when I do that. So it's a matter of they don't understand. And we had a fight, and American kids, you know, like they know how to blah, blah, blah away, and then they run off, and I keep ending up in the detention all the time. Most of the time, and then I couldn't argue about it. I couldn't explain myself, and I feel very sad and angry, and I wanted to kill myself, and, you know, and lucky I didn't do it. And my foster father really encouraged me to talk about my life, and I was willing to share it, and I don't know. It was a really hard time. I had a hard time in an early year, yeah.
It sounds like for you it was... Talking about your experiences was important, but for you, continuing to be in touch with Cambodian culture was important. And what I think is really interesting is the effort that you have launched to teach young Cambodian American kids, teenage kids, teach them something about traditional Cambodian music. But you also went back to Cambodia, and that's one of the things that people say in the film, that you went back to Cambodia to try to find great Cambodian performers, musical artists, singers, and instrumentalists, and try to answer the question, did some of them manage to survive? Because people like that were targeted by the Khmer. And actually, you managed to find a number of people that did. Some of the people that were apparently some of the most famous musicians in Cambodia somehow managed to survive that time. And you found them, you made contact with them, you helped them to do some recording. And also to you know, do what you could to encourage then younger people to learn to play these instruments and learn traditional Cambodian music.
Yeah, later on in I started. In fact, this project now known as a Cambodian Living Arts. We work under like World Education, the big organization worldwide. They took us under their wing, and because we didn't have much money, now we plan to move out of that. But it happened in Lowell, Massachusetts, where I worked with the gang members, former gang members who like Cambodian, Chinese gang member, Latino, black kid. I was able to, start playing music and I found a master in Lowell to try a master of traditional music, you know, music to come and teach these young people. I don't know why, by miracle, I convinced this kid to learn. I mean, they're hip hop, they rap, they're a rapper, and I encourage them to talk about their lives too. I mean, they have their own life, even though it's different from mine in Cambodia, but they struggle in the street of Lowell too, like a street of Providence. About, I mean, the big thing is, I think for these kids, or even for me, and I know now for everyone, it's a struggle to find out who we are, who we really are, you know? If we don't know where we are, who we are, because the reason we don't know where we came from. And if we don't know where we came from, we tend to confuse who we are, and we don't know where we are going in life. That's connected, all these things, you know? So I just say, you know, let's try it. If we can find out who we were, and then you probably feel good about who you are, and then you have a plan to go where you will be going in life. And they gave me a try, they trust me enough. And then I even, some of the kids in the flute player, you see, they play. And then I sort of transported to go to Cambodia and start this project in Cambodia, and I found a master, one master who I remembered. Her name Chek Mike. She's one of the last opera singer ever. She was the first one who died in the year 2003 in our program, and we will miss her. And she was drunk and sad because she now, they don't know who she is now because the war just ended, and she's now afraid to tell her name, and she's afraid, you know, that she didn't even know that the Khmer Rouge years ended. So she was drunk. She doesn't know, you know. And I found out her on the street selling chocolate and cigarettes, and she was drunk. And I picked her up, and I took her to you know, record. And then I was able to think about starting this project called the Cambodian Living Arts. And now I found my two teachers, the one that was killed. And then I forget to tell you that they brought another teacher to me, and we both survived. We both.
And that meant he's in the movie.
Yeah, the guy who's his name Yun Mek. He's mm-hmm. in Battam Bong, and I was very happy. He's also drunk and about to die in Cambodia. So he's now joining, and now we have about 12 masters in 12 provinces, and we have about 500 students coming all over Cambodia, and some are former prostitutes who are young and prostituting themselves. You know, a lot of problems, social issues that we need to address. And I'm glad that Cambodian Living Art can help them to bring them to learn traditional instruments. We give them stipend. And we also ask American family here to help sponsor some of them, or some sponsor a class, or sponsor a teacher, or something like that. So that's how I do it. And you know, teaching music and art is how you can express yourself. That's why the Khmer Rouge killed all of them. 90%. This is just a number, but 90%. It's no number that the Khmer Rouge slaughtered mostly musician performers, let's say, and only 10% left, and we are, our culture is really deep trouble. So, and this is not old culture, you know, old country, like thousands of years. We have the temple called Angkor Wat, and we have old and flourish culture, and the Khmer Rouge sort of like starting year zero, and they kill, they burn everything from to the ground. So we have a lot of work to rescue that culture, you know, and music.
We have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Arun Chornpond is our guest. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. He'll be giving a talk, talking some about his experiences, his life, his work in trying to promote and resurrect traditional Cambodian arts, music particularly. The Flute Player, Moving Beyond the Madness of War, that's what it's called. That's tonight at 7 in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. It's free, open to the public. Anyone can attend. Also, you might look for the film, The Flute Player, that was aired nationally on PBS as part of the POV series, which is about him, and in which he tells the story of his life. And the woman who made the film went with him to Cambodia, and you get a chance to see him as he meets with some of these masters. Particularly Chakmak, it was such a sad story, you'd think. And when she talked about her life, one time having been very famous, very successful, very prosperous, and then when the Khmer Rouge came in, she was literally reduced to singing for food. She apparently somehow managed to survive, and she would still sing, and apparently people knew who she was, and to try to help her out, they would give her whatever they had she could actually at least have something to eat.
No, she's lucky at all to survive at all, to sing for those people. I mean, for the Khmer Rouge, they would have killed her if they know that she was like. She reminded me when I met her first time of, you know, I love Lucy. I like to watch that show, and I in New Hampshire, and she reminded me of like I love Lucy Ball.
Really?
Lucy Ball, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And she was, after we revived her, she was like, you know, when every time I took her to recording, she just like say, you know, Arne, she called me son. You know, Arne, if find me a sandwich. She used the word sandwich in English, and a sandwich and a beer. she beer and rice, a little bit of rice and all that. It's like a ceremony for her personally. She just say, give it to me that, and after I eat, then I can record for you. You know, a sandwich, and she know like the word dollar. You know, American dollars. She know if I told her a song $10, she knows what it is. So her character is begin to revive, and she began to act like she's a queen. She is a queen, you know, and so she start talking alive, become alive again, you know. And so my teacher, Mr. Mac, he's not talking very much because he's a musician. He's not a performer in per se. Mm-hmm. But he's a musician, and when he talks about our ordeals during the Khmer Rouge, very few times he's really broke down. He had a hard time crying, just like all of us. But the more we learn how to cry together, I hug him, he hugged me, and I think the better we heal ourselves, we feel better after that. You know, we're just learning how to do that more and more now, how to sit and talk to each other and cry more and more. I think that probably the only way we will survive also, you know, in our lives. To be a human being again. Yeah. He knew that I've been forced by the Khmer Rouge to do a lot of bad things, you know, to even kill people. And if you care and you try to be human and care about the victim, you go crazy, you can't do it. And if you cannot do it, then the Khmer Rouge kill you. So either way, so he knew that I need to cry, and I knew that he needs to cry. And I don't know, it just happened. And that we cried uncontrollably, and we assured each other that we have a lot of things to cry about. And he said, you know, let do it before we had a heart attack and die, you know. So this, we are learning together now how to do this. Not only just playing music also while we are doing that. You know, music is... I think it's so important for us that we can express ourselves even though we don't talk. We don't need to talk about things sometimes. We just hear music and literally I feel like when I understand it, how kids, you know, these former prostitutes and all of these things, they were timid and afraid in the street. But when we ask them to dance, they're right away to perform. They're like, you know, they have a really happy faces and they, the confidence in them, you know, the confidence by performing for other people, you know, the act of showing someone and giving someone a performance. It's really, I see the confidence in this kid change. So, you know, to express yourself, the art is really, the dancing, the music is really... We don't have, I think naturally, you know, it reaches us in the soul, you know, and how we can express. That's why I think the reason the Khmer Rouge is targeting them, because that, how we want to express ourselves through music, through singing, and we're not going along with the evil, you know, act that they're doing. So they kill most of the artists because we can't stay silent. They want to silence us, you know.
I was really, with some of the performers that are in the documentary, I was so impressed by the depth of feeling that comes from the music. Particularly, there were two people, they were singers, and they were young people, so they had to have been people who were children at the Khmer Rouge time. And I think one of them was your cousin.
I
thought his voice was so beautiful. It had so much emotion. Now, the song that he was singing was a very emotional song that you see him sing, but something about the quality of his voice, actually it made me think of the stringed instrument. I'm not sure what it's called. It's like the Cambodian equivalent of the violin. The sound of his voice and the tone of his voice, to me, sound almost had some of that same quality of that stringed instrument. I was just haunted by it. It was so beautiful.
And my father is supposed to teach me how to be an opera star, and instead I was too young, too small, and he taught my cousin, and he survived Pol Pot, and I'm glad to he's one of the young master in the program. The rest are there in their 80s, late 70s, you know. Yeah. So we don't have them for too long, but we are now emphasize on recording and performing and teaching and also promoting them in the world stage. You know, in the year 2020, I would love to have Cambodia everywhere you go. Someday you can visit, Anne can visit, you know. I want to say thank you to Anne for inviting me here to speak at the school. And I hope she can go to Cambodia someday. And you, when you get off the plane in Cambodia, it's peace now, and a lot of work we need to be doing there to help out the social problem, you know, to address the social issue. that everywhere you go, you would hear kids playing music and dancing and playing musical instruments for all of us, you know, not be reminded of the, be reminded but not known of as the killing field, you know, but as of my culture, my beautiful culture and music. That's what I'm targeting the year 2020. So I'm on my way, but it's just fun to do this work, and I'm really happy, you know, to be doing this. And
we're coming down, and I'm sorry, we just have a few minutes left. You have your flute. Would you play for us?
I would, yeah. And I also want to say thank you also to Jocelyn Kletzer. She's in Boston now, who's doing the film. And the films, I'm so happy it's going many places that we never thought of. You know, we never know that this film going anywhere, but we just do it for the sake of the suffering of Cambodian people. Now it goes places. So I thank you to her for doing that.
It's a very moving film, and as I said, it is available on a DVD. So people, you know, go to the places where you rent your DVDs. Go to the library. Yeah. There's an Asian media instructional media center here on the campus. That's where we borrowed our copy. So it is possible to see this movie, and it's called The Flute Player. And I would certainly suggest people seek it out. Slowly. Does that tune have a name?
Yeah, it's called Aup Tei Srok Khmae. It means the Cambodian's scenery of the rice fields, I think. Oh. Yeah, it's a children's song that the Khmer Rouge eradicated, and I relearn now.
So that's an old tune? People have been playing that for a long time?
Yeah, it's an old tune. We don't know when it existed, but it's like a fairy tale old tune. It's about, in the 60s, probably people composed that, and it's about a rice field. You can imagine it when the rain comes and people doing, harvesting the rice in a beautiful, beautiful landscape of the rice field, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lovely tune.
Yeah,
I guess I'm very, very struck by just the powerful emotions there are in this music, and how clearly that seems to me to come across. Even when I was watching the film, the singers are singing in Cambodian, so there's a translation, so you know what they're saying. Mm-hmm. But somehow I felt that even you'd know that there was powerful emotions here, even if you didn't know what it was they were singing about. I think that comes across.
And just recently, Peter Gabriel, you know, in just brought our kid for the first time from Cambodia to perform at Edinburgh.
At the big music festival.
For the first time, they got 5-star. Some of our kids, they never been out of the country before, and they came back, you know, like millions of people watch them on TV, and they love Cambodian music, you know. So I won for the first time, this Kung Nai, you know, the blind long neck guitar player.
Yeah,
he's like known as Ray Charles of Cambodia.
This is the
Peter
Gabriel
loved him.
And he actually he kind of looks like Ray Charles.
Yeah, he looks a little bit. That's why we give him the name.
I was knocked out by this guy's music because it sounds really bluesy.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes he's improvised. You know, he improvised when you give him a topic to say. He's just so good, and Peter loved him, and he performed with Peter on stage, and they've never seen anything like that. So I mean, more and more now Cambodian music now because of this program, it's spread. I want them to be all over the world, and the world enjoy it, not only England. But I'm planning the next 2 years, 2010, for Carnegie Hall. That's going to be the first time we are on that, and I wish I pray that it's happening. It will happen. I can see it already, that this guy would come and would play in the Carnegie Hall in New York, and I hope, you know, all of us show up to see. And I want to say thank you for Anne for bringing me here. She's sitting at the room, and because of her, I'm here to talk to the young people here, and I hope I can come back next year.
Well, and for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, you'd like to hear more from our guest, Arn Chornpond. Now, he'll be speaking about his experiences, about his life, about his work with Cambodian music and musicians. This is part of the Millercom series, The Flute Player, Moving Beyond the Madness of War, Arn Chornpond. He'll be giving a talk tonight at 7 p.m. This is in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus. And these events are always free and open to the public. Anyone who is interested should certainly feel welcome to attend. And are there actually recordings, some of the recordings of the masters that you've done that are actually commercially available?
Yes. two came out, and the other one, Peter Gabriel have helped to build. I asked him, I know him many years through Reebok Human Rights. I was a Reebok Human Rights recipient. That's how I know him, through the Amnesty International World Tour. And he said, "Arn, you never asked me to do anything to help." So I asked him finally, and he helped to build this first international standard studio in Cambodia, in Phnom Penh. So we record two master CD and sell in Cambodia yet, and he's going to try to help to sell it in the world. The other one is coming out, like jazz, Cambodian. We explore new things. We brought American jazz boys from San Francisco to go study there for a year and play music with the masters. And Peter Gabriel also done another one, just came out with the one master and one outstanding student together. They sing a love song together, and now it's out, and I hope it will be in the store in everywhere. Not yet exposed international yet, but Peters is helping out a lot.
So. Well, there we got to leave it. Arn Chornpond, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me here.